Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to season 4 of the Umayyad Caliphate. This is the third and final episode of this season. Let's start with a quick recap of where we are so far. In the previous episode, we discussed several major defeats for the Muslims throughout the Khilafat. It started with the disastrous loss of the Muslim city of Ardabil in the Caucasus at the hands of the Khazar Khaganate. This defeat resulted in the death and enslavement of tens of thousands of Muslims. On top of that, the governor of Ardabil was also killed in this battle, which was a rare occurrence. Around this same time, the Muslims were also engaged in a desperate fight in Khorasan. This was the Battle of the Defile, where the Muslims were defeated by the Turkish Khaganate. Things are not going too well in the western provinces either. In 113 AH, the Muslims were defeated by Charles Martel and the Franks at the Battle of Poitiers. These setbacks and Caliph Hisham's policy of perpetual expansion stretched the Umayyads' resources to the limit. What we're going to see in this episode is that the Umayyads have to make certain compromises. They start relying more on Iraqi troops who were notoriously fickle. In some regions, particularly in the Caucasus, they even have to ally with non-Muslims. And since he needed money to fund his war machine, Caliph Hisham begins looking for ways to squeeze more revenue out of his subjects. This will lead to conflict with both Arabs and non-Arabs, Muslims and non-Muslims. And ultimately, this will add one more item to the growing list of grievances against the Umayyad Caliphate. Now let's talk a little bit about this episode you're about to hear, inshallah. As we just mentioned, the Umayyad Caliphate suffered from major defeats on multiple fronts from 112 to 114 AH, which roughly corresponds to 731 to 733 CE. Nonetheless, Caliph Hisham ibn Abdul Malik remained committed to his policy of perpetual expansion. The Umayyad military machine was forced to make temporary peace treaties with its various enemies, but it didn't take long for it to come roaring back to life, or maybe more accurately, whimpering back to life. As we'll see, the Umayyads did learn from their mistakes and had more success between the years of 115 to 120 AH, which are the years that we're going to cover today, inshallah. For example, they finally defeated the Turkish Khaganate of Khorasan in battle. The Umayyads even made a comeback in Sindh, and they started capturing more territory in France. But all of these victories were kind of hollow and short-lived. They drained the Caliphate of blood and treasure that it just didn't have to spare, and they prevented the Caliph, that is Caliph Hisham, from focusing on improving the lives of the people he ruled over. And as we'll see in this episode, the Mawali were starting to make more noise about the unjust tax policy that they were suffering under. On top of that, Hisham engaged in playing rival Arab tribes against each other, and corruption was rampant as his governors hoarded wealth and tortured their predecessors to get the wealth that they had hoarded. The Umayyads were steadily weakening themselves, making it easy for another group to come along and topple them. This episode, inshallah, is going to cover the years 114 AH to 120 AH, which, as I mentioned, corresponds to 732 to 738 CE. And as we've done in previous episodes this season, we'll look at the various parts of the Khilafat and discuss the many different events taking place during this time period. Let's start with the year 115 AH. During this year, Syria and Khorasan were both hit with drought and famine. The governor of Khorasan at this time, Junayd al-Muri, he began sending requests to the surrounding areas and regions asking them to send food and supplies to Merv, which was the Umayyad capital of Khorasan. The plague that began in 115 AH was still going on in 116 AH and had even also spread to Iraq. This might have been part of what's known historically as the First Plague Pandemic. Listen to this excerpt from Wikipedia.
The first plague pandemic was the first historically recorded old world pandemic of plague, the contagious disease caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis. Also called the early medieval pandemic, it began with the plague of Justinian in 541 and continued until 750 or 767. At least 15 to 18 major waves of plague following the Justinianic plague have been identified from historical records. The pandemic affected the Mediterranean basin most severely and most frequently, but also infected the Near East and Northern Europe and potentially East Asia as well.
In 116 AH, the governor of Khorasan, Junaid al-Muradi, married a woman named Fadila bint Yazid. Fadila bint Yazid was the daughter of Yazid ibn Muhallab, and that name should sound familiar to you if you're a longtime listener to the Umayyad Caliphate series. Yazid ibn Muhallab had led a revolt against Hisham's brother and predecessor, Yazid ibn Abdul Malik. With this marriage between the daughter of Yazid ibn Muhallab and Junaid al-Muradi angered Caliph Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, and he deposed Junaid and sent a new governor named Asim ibn Abdullah to take over. Hisham might have also been upset with Junaid's military performance in the field. After all, Junaid was the commander at the Battle of the Defile. Hisham ordered Asim ibn Abdullah, the new incoming governor of Khorasan, to kill Junaid when he reached Khorasan, at least according to Tariq al-Tabari. But as it turned out, Junaid al-Muradi didn't last that long. He died before the new governor, Asim ibn Abdullah, arrived. Junaid had been suffering from dropsy or edema. Edema is a disease that causes swelling due to fluid buildup in the body. You've probably seen this in elderly people, especially in their legs and around their ankles. But it can also happen in other parts of the body like the brain or the lungs, and both of these can lead to death. Well, Junaid al-Muradi died before Asim ibn Abdullah arrived. And as usual, when Asim ibn Abdullah arrived in Khorasan and took over, he began imprisoning and torturing Junaid's officials. Now let's talk about the revolt of Al-Harith ibn Suraj. Al-Harith ibn Suraj rose up in rebellion against the Umayyads the same year that Asim ibn Abdullah took over in Khorasan. We've discussed Al-Harith ibn Suraj in the previous episode where he participated in the Battle of Baykand. This took place in 110 AH when the governor of Khorasan at that time offered to lift the jizya on the Turks who accepted Islam. Well, this governor, Ashras ibn Abdullah al-Sulami, he reneged on this offer, and this led to a revolt amongst the Mawali. Well, the Turkish Khaganate took advantage of this conflict and joined in on the rebel side, which led to the Battle of Baykand in modern-day Uzbekistan. Al-Harith ibn Suraj fought on the side of the Umayyads against the Mawali rebels. But now, in 116 AH, Al-Harith ibn Suraj was revolting against the Umayyads, demanding that the Umayyads honor the rights of the Mawali. At least this was the stated primary cause of his rebellion. He insisted that the government stop mistreating the Mawali and rule according to the Quran and Sunnah. Well, many different and diverse groups joined this rebellion. Al-Harith was joined by both northern and southern Arab clans, as well as both Muslim and non-Muslim Turks.
Arab sympathy for the injustices visited on the Sogdian Mawali is connected above all with the movement of Al-Harith ibn Suraj. Al-Harith was a Tamimi, that is, Mudari Arab, who led a movement both of Arabs, Mudar in Yemen, and of Sogdia Mawali, supporting the rights of the latter as Muslims, opposing the Umayyads on religious grounds and demanding their acceptance of the Book and the Sunnah, but willing to ally with the non-Muslim Turgesh in pursuit of his demands. This seems to be the first such case of Muslims willing to ally with non-Muslims against other Muslims. G.R. Hawtin, The First Dynasty of Islam, the Umayyad Caliphate, AD 661 to 750.
Al-Harith ibn Suraj's revolt started in a city called Andhuy in northern Afghanistan, which is about 110 miles west of Mazar-i-Sharif. Al-Harith led his forces east, coming into contact with the army of Balkh. Balkh is also in northern Afghanistan, and the governor of Balkh at this time was Nasr ibn Sayyar. We have mentioned this name in the past. We discussed him in the first episode of the season. He participated in the fighting at Al-Barukan between the Mudar and the Yemeni Arabs, or the northern and southern Arabs. Nasr ibn Sayyar led the pro-Umayyad Mudari Arabs, that is northern Arabs, against the kind of anti-Umayyad Yemeni Arabs. Al-Harith was successful, and now with most of northern Afghanistan under his control, he headed west towards Merv. Merv, which is in modern Turkmenistan, was the Umayyad capital of Khorasan, and this is where Asim ibn Abdullah, the new governor of Khorasan, was located. Well, the army of Merv gathered and they came out to meet Al-Harith's rebel forces to fight against them. Interestingly, however, Asim ibn Abdullah had to pay the men in Merv's army, he had to pay them extra to get them to fight for Merv. This is an indication of their reluctance to put their lives on the line for the Umayyad authority. Many of them didn't want to fight and in effect had even been in correspondence with Al-Harith ibn Suraj. They only agreed to defend Merv when Asim ibn Abdullah, the governor, threatened to abandon the city and ask the caliph to send 10,000 Syrian soldiers. Well, Al-Harith's forces were much greater than the Umayyad forces at Merv. At-Tabari says that he had about 60,000 forces compared to about 4,000 defending the city. It's important to note that many of the rebels that joined in with Al-Harith ibn Suraj had taken part in the rebellion that was the Battle of Baykant that we discussed earlier. This shows that the disapproval of Umayyad authority was still going strong. Asim ibn Abdullah was forced to fight a defensive battle because his forces were so small. He destroyed the bridges crossing the canals near Merv, and then his men took up fortified positions in a village just outside of the city. But despite his overwhelming advantage in numbers, Al-Harith ibn Suraj just didn't fare that well in this battle. First of all, a faction of his forces defected over to the Umayyad side. Secondly, thousands of Al-Harith's forces drowned in the canals near Merv because, as we mentioned, Asim ibn Abdullah had destroyed the bridges. Well, ultimately, Al-Harith ibn Suraj and his rebel forces were defeated and they had to retreat. Most of his remaining soldiers, which, as we mentioned, was sort of a hodgepodge of various religions and ethnic groups, most of them eventually abandoned him and he was left with only about 3,000 loyal troops. But despite this defeat, Al-Harith ibn Suraj and this rebel movement were not done yet. Let's take a look and see how things are shaping up in the Caucasus between the years 115 to 116 AH. Let's first discuss the overall situation in the Caucasus. First of all, the ongoing war that was taking place between the Umayyads and the Caucasus Khazars, that was one of the most challenging struggles for the Umayyads. Caliph Hisham had changed governors multiple times between the years 110 AH and 114 AH. Let's just go through a rundown of the various governors. First, he deposed his own half-brother, Maslama ibn Abdul Malik, in favor of another governor named Al-Jarrah al-Hakami. Al-Jarrah was killed in 112 AH during the siege of Ardabil, and he was replaced by Sa'id al-Harashi as the military commander in the Caucasus. But then Caliph Hisham reinstated Maslama ibn Abdul Malik as governor of the Caucasus, but then he deposed Maslama again in 114 AH and replaced him with Marwan ibn Muhammad, who was the grandson of Marwan ibn al-Hakam, who was the grandfather of Caliph Hisham ibn Abdul Malik. Well, under the leadership of Marwan ibn Muhammad, the Caucasus began to improve. In the previous episode, we mentioned how he had developed a strong relationship with the Christian Armenians of the region. And in 114 AH, Marwan ibn Muhammad led a campaign to recapture some of the territory that the Muslims had lost to the Khazars. Even though he did gain some plunder, he did not really regain much territory, and this was followed by an uneasy, peaceful period between the Muslims, represented by the Umayyads, and the Caucasus Khazars. But despite this peace and relative stability, Caliph Hisham deposed Marwan ibn Muhammad in 115 AH. The thing is that Caliph Hisham, he didn't really have patience with governors that were not aggressive enough. And even if they were aggressive, if they weren't successful in the battlefield, they could still be deposed anyway. Maslama ibn Abdul Malik, who was governor of the Caucasus at least twice, was very aggressive, but he was also very unsuccessful, which is why Hisham deposed him multiple times. Marwan ibn Muhammad was deposed, and Hisham installed Sa'id al-Harashi as governor of the Caucasus. We have mentioned Sa'id al-Harashi in earlier episodes and in earlier seasons of the Umayyad Caliphate. We mentioned in the previous season how he was very harsh against the Sogdians of Ferghana, and he was also very aggressive when he took over the military in the Caucasus after the fall of the city of Ardabil. Caliph Hisham expected Sa'id al-Harashi to exhibit the same aggression now that he was governor of the Caucasus. But in fact, al-Harashi did not launch any new campaigns in the Caucasus in either the year 115 nor in 116 AH. Most likely this was because the Muslim troops defending the Caucasus were just exhausted and stretched too thin. So instead of wasting more money and more lives on offensive military campaigns, Sa'id al-Harashi preferred to strengthen his defensive position. But in 117 AH, Sa'id al-Harashi stepped down as governor of the Caucasus due to his failing vision, his failing eyesight, and Marwan ibn Muhammad was reinstated by Caliph Hisham as governor of the Caucasus again. Let's revisit an area that we haven't discussed in a while, and that is Africa. We'll begin with Egypt, which we haven't really discussed much at all this season. That's because Egypt was generally free of military activity during this period of the Umayyad Khilafat. It was one of the central provinces of the Umayyad Khilafat, and right next to the Umayyads' home base of Syria. However, there was some rebellious activity early on in Hisham's caliphate, and we're going to talk about some of that now. It seems that there was some unrest from the Bija people. The Bija are an ethnic group native to the Eastern Desert. The Eastern Desert is the part of Egypt east of the Nile River that is between the Nile River and the Red Sea. During the Umayyad era, the Bija people were predominantly Christian with their own language and their own culture. However, over the centuries, not surprisingly, they've intermarried with Arabs and now they have mostly adopted Islam and they speak Arabic along with their native language. Their native language is not dead, but they predominantly do speak Arabic. There isn't much information about the nature of the unrest the Bija experienced during this period of Hisham's reign, but whatever it was, they struck a deal with a man named Ubaydullah ibn al-Habhab. They agreed to pay an annual tribute in slaves, and this was likely around the year 106 AH. This man, Ubaydullah ibn al-Habhab, was a Mawla himself, that means he was not Arab, but he had risen to a high level in the Umayyad administration. And at the time, he was serving as the finance minister for Egypt, which is pretty rare for someone who was the son of a slave to reach such a high position in this era. In 107 AH, Ubaydullah ibn al-Habhab, we're just going to call him Ibn al-Habhab instead of saying his whole name, Ibn al-Habhab got involved with another ethnic minority group in Egypt. This time it was the Copts, not C-O-P-S, C-O-P-T-S, the Coptics, the Coptic people of Egypt. While the Copts had mostly accepted Muslim rule, they were still Christian for the most part, and many of them still are even today. But they had mostly accepted Muslim rule in Egypt without much political unrest. But things changed when Ibn al-Habhab raised taxes on the Coptic people of Egypt by 4.17% and imposed forced labor on them. This led to a Coptic revolt, which took 3 months to put down. But due to this revolt, Ibn al-Habhab asked Caliph Hisham to send 3,000 Arab soldiers to settle in eastern Egypt, but only about half of these troops wound up remaining in Egypt. In 112 AH, Ibn al-Habhab again raised taxes on the Copts, this time by 12.5%. This led to higher prices in Egypt, thereby causing additional financial hardship for the Coptic people and increasing their disillusionment and their disgruntlement with the Umayyad Khilafat. Then in 117 AH, a Kharijite rebellion broke out in the Egyptian capital. At this time, it was Fustat. This mostly involved the Yemenis, or the southern Arabs, of Egypt, and it was eventually suppressed, but not without a lot of difficulty. That same year, still 117 AH, Caliph Hisham authorized new scoops to measure grain for the soldiers. Try to help you understand this, the scoops of grain was part of the soldiers' rations. These new scoops that Caliph Hisham had authorized were smaller than before, which meant that the soldiers were now getting less grain than before, and this was obviously just another cost-cutting method from Caliph Hisham. And now we see why he had the reputation of being a very stingy person. Well, the soldiers weren't stupid. They could see that they were getting smaller scoops, and they started breaking their scoops and refused to accept these new rations. And ultimately, Caliph Hisham had to reverse this policy. In 118 AH, an Umayyad naval force departed from Egypt and attempted to attack a Byzantine island, but not only did this attack fail, but the Byzantines intercepted the Muslim naval force as they returned home, and the Byzantines completely destroyed the Muslim fleet. With that loss, Caliph Hisham dismissed Egypt's governor. So that's Egypt. Let's look at the rest of North Africa. Just like Egypt, North Africa, or Ifriqiya as it was known at the time, was fairly stable during this period. There was very little friction between the Umayyads and the Berbers after the Berbers killed the former Umayyad governor. We discussed this in the past episode, but I'll just quickly recap it. The Berbers killed the governor because the governor tried to impose jizya on the Berbers after they had accepted Islam. Well, after the Berbers killed their governor, the Umayyads wisely lifted this un-Islamic requirement, and this brought more stability to North Africa. During this period of stability, the Berbers began accepting Islam in large numbers. And as the Berbers began accepting Islam and trying to learn more about Islam, they came into contact with Muslim scholars and da'is. If you're not familiar with the phrase da'i, that basically means missionary in Arabic. That's the closest English equivalent that I could think of. These scholars and da'is, these scholars and missionaries, so to speak, were men who were devoted to Islam, but they were not necessarily devoted to the Umayyad government. The Berbers began to learn of the un-Islamic behavior of the Umayyads from these scholars and da'is, and this almost certainly further increased Berber antagonism towards the Umayyads. Now, on the military side of things, the Umayyad regime was more focused on naval campaigns against the Byzantine islands in the Mediterranean Sea. The Umayyads began launching increasingly more campaigns over the years, but these campaigns often resulted in disastrous failures. And these defeats, these naval failures, increased the overall disapproval of the Umayyad government in North Africa. In 115 AH, the Umayyads launched an expedition against Trapani, which is on the island of Sicily. The Byzantines who were defending Trapani used Greek fire to destroy the Muslim naval fleet, and just like before, with this defeat, Caliph Hisham deposed the governor of North Africa and replaced him with Ubaydullah ibn al-Habhab in 116 AH. Ubaydullah ibn al-Habhab, we just mentioned him a few minutes ago, he was the former finance minister of Egypt, the one who had so many problems with the non-Arabs in Egypt. Well, he was now the governor of Ifriqiya. There is some speculation that Caliph Hisham appointed Ibn al-Habhab as governor of Ifriqiya because he wanted the Muslim Berbers of Ifriqiya to start paying the jizya tax again. And considering Ibn al-Habhab's track record in Egypt, this isn't really a far-fetched idea. Ibn al-Habhab had already raised taxes on two ethnic minority groups in Egypt, Perhaps Hisham was hoping that he could do the same thing in North Africa with the Berbers. Allah knows best, but if this is true, it shows just how badly Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, the caliph, needed money to finance his wars. We'll discuss the Berbers much more in the next season, inshallah. Let's go back to Khorasan and see what's happening in the year 117 AH. This is the year that Caliph Hisham dismissed his new governor of Khorasan, Asim ibn Abdullah. But let's see what happened that led up to this dismissal. It all began when Asim ibn Abdullah wrote a letter giving advice to the caliph. Asim ibn Abdullah wrote a letter to Caliph Hisham advising him to make Khorasan part of Iraq again. Most of the time that Khorasan had been part of the Islamic Khilafat, it had been a sub-province under Iraq. However, as we mentioned in earlier episodes, in 109 AH, Caliph Hisham made it an independent province. That means that the governor of Khorasan answered directly to the caliph instead of to the governor of Iraq. We discussed that, I believe, in the first episode of this season. So now Asim ibn Abdullah, he was the governor of Khorasan, but he's making the argument that Khorasan was too far from Damascus for this system to work. And this made it difficult for the caliph to send supplies or troops to defend Khorasan. So with this, it kind of appears that Asim ibn Abdullah was making himself irrelevant with this advice. But the reality is that Asim ibn Abdullah really did not control much territory in Khorasan. Between the Turkish Khaganate invasions and Al-Harith ibn Sulayj's rebellion, all Asim ibn Abdullah really controlled was Merv and parts of Nishapur in Iran. And when you look at a map, you'll see that they're really not that far apart from each other, only about 200 miles. So what did Hisham do with this advice? He responded by sending a new governor of Khorasan, Asad al-Kasri, and thousands more soldiers. So Asad al-Kasri became the governor of Khorasan for the second time. If that name sounds familiar, it's because Asad al-Kasri was the brother of the governor of Iraq, Khalid al-Kasri. The same year that Asad al-Kasri was appointed as the new governor of Khorasan, this is 117 AH, the rebel al-Harith ibn Sudayj made a comeback. He led another assault on Merv. Now, Asim ibn Abdullah was still the governor, but Asad al-Kasri was on his way with 20,000 Syrian soldiers. Al-Harith ibn Sudayj and his forces, they fought Asim ibn Abdullah's forces at a town called Adandakan, which was just southwest of Merv in modern Turkmenistan. Once again, the Umayyad forces, led by the outgoing governor, Asim ibn Abdullah, they defeated the rebels and executed 80 rebel captives. But Al-Harith ibn Sudayj himself, he managed to survive, and he withdrew with his remaining troops. Al-Harith ibn Sudayj still held territory in Khorasan, and he still had a lot of support. And so with this, Asim ibn Abdullah made a very strange peace agreement or peace offer to Al-Harith ibn Sudayj. Listen to this excerpt from Tariq al-Tabari.
He drew up a document between the two of them stipulating that Al-Harith could abide in whatever districts of Khorasan he wished and that the two of them would write together to Hisham, asking him to obey the Book of God and the Sunnah of his Prophet. If he refused, they were to join together against him. Tariq al-Tabari, Volume 25, page 115.
So this meant that these two men would join forces, or at least join influences, and would demand that Caliph Hisham rule according to whatever their definition of the Quran and Sunnah was, and if he didn't, then they would join forces and rebel against him together. Now, some of Asim ibn Abdullah's officials who were in Merv, they still supported the Umayyads and they denounced this plan. They were completely against it. In hindsight, or in historical hindsight, I should say, it is likely that Asim ibn Abdullah was just doing this to stall for more time. And he fully intended to double cross Al-Harith ibn Sudayj at the first opportunity. It's very likely that he might have just been waiting for reinforcements to arrive from Syria. But even though this might have been the plot, Even though he may have been plotting against Al-Harith ibn Suraj, this shows just how tenuous the Umayyad hold was in Khorasan.
For the shallowness of any loyalty felt by most of the Khorasani army to the regime had been nakedly displayed. Not only the indigenous Khorasanis, both Arabs and Mawali, but apparently also the 20,000 Iraqis, or what was left of them, who had been sent to Khorasan only 4 years previously, refused to come to the government's help. That meant no reliance could be put on further mobilizations of Iraqis to meet the manpower shortage on the Khorasani front. Only one solution was left, the one suggested by Asim: more Syrian troops. The End of the Jihad State by Khalid Yahya Blankenship.